Occultism, on the other hand, teaches those who pursue it to function on the inner planes themselves, and as these levels of manifestation are the planes of causation in respect of the physical plane, it is possible, within certain limits varying with the attainments of the individual, to influence conditions on the physical plane. No hard and fast line can be drawn between spiritualist and occult activities in these matters, for it is obvious to all who have any practical experience of both movements that they overlap, but broadly speaking, the two movements will be found to have differentiated along the lines described because they have specialized along those lines, not because their activities are mutually exclusive. That occultism has owed much to mediumship is witnessed by the tradition of the oracles and the well-known life story of Madame Blavatsky, after whose death C.W. Leadbeater, her student, continued to keep open the lines of psychic communication. The lesser-known history of MacGregor Mathers, the great English occultist, who used his wife as his medium, and his collaborator, Brodie Innes, who was himself mediumistic, confirmed the tradition. The question is frequently asked as to whether the Fraternity of the Inner Light makes use of mediums and psychics, and whether Dionne Fortune, its warden, is herself a medium. Hitherto information has been refused on this point to all save those in the higher grades of its own organization. The time has now come, however, to give an answer. The fraternity trains its students, to begin with, in the philosophy of the esoteric tradition and in the practice of meditation. Advancing beyond this grade, they are developed psychically and taught how to enter the inner planes by the traditional paths. Advancing further, they study their art of operating the astral forces. All members take their part in the scrying, or clairvoyance, according to capacity, but are not encouraged to act as mediums for each other, as they are expected to go on to the inner planes themselves and make direct contact with the masters, by means of the meditation methods by which they are trained. A line of direct communication is always kept open, however, but it is operated from the inner planes, and the members of the fraternity do not sit for development in mediumship. Dionne Fortune at present holds this office, which she took over from her predecessor and teacher, who likewise received it from his teacher. But individual members have from time to time, according to capacity, had experiences that have enabled them to test for themselves the inner plane contacts claim for their fraternity. These have also been counter-checked recently by mediums belonging to well-known spiritualist organizations. The fraternity has never used psychic phenomena as a proof of the validity of its teaching, knowing that these phenomena, like miracles, prove nothing save their own existence and that teachings must be judged by their intrinsic content. The lines of communication with the inner planes which are used by occultists are more sensitive than those used by spiritualists, and more easily disturbed by adverse psychic influences. Consequently, their work has to be guarded by the traditional seclusion, and our friends must forgive us if there is a certain reticence about our reference to them. No doubt we shall in time profit by our contact with the spiritualist movement to improve our technique and throw open more widely the doors of the mysteries. At present we must feel our way and make haste slowly in practical matters involving a break with age, old tradition. It may be as well to say a few words here concerning the use of ceremonial, which plays so important a part in occultism but of which spiritualism has hitherto only so far availed itself in a very minor degree. The arrangement of the sitters in a circle, the playing of soft music, the singing of hymns and the prayers of dedication and invocation commonly practiced in home circles are ritual of a simple kind. But there are aspects of ritual little realized by those who have not seen them, and their beauty and power bring through manifestations which, if subjected to psychic investigation, should yield very interesting results. At the present moment, with the war hampering all our activities and dispersing our trained personnel, it is difficult, in fact almost impossible, for us to work these rituals in a way that shall do them justice. And ceremonial badly done is a very undesirable thing, but when happier days come, and they are already showing signs of dawning, we look forward to developments from the sharing of the occult and the spiritualistic resources, and go, operation with other occult organizations which shall enrich the field of human knowledge for all men, and not just for one secret fraternity. This can only come about through generosity and open-mindedness on both sides. In some quarters we have met with these truly Christian qualities in an abundance that has led to most happy relationships, in others, they have been regrettably lacking. May we be allowed to say that if we are right in believing that it is the will of those great ones behind both movements that there should be brotherly co-operation between their respective servers, then those organizations that will not co-operate will find themselves left behind by the march of events, and that the wonderful influx of new life that is flowing down upon us all from the inner planes will be unable to penetrate channels that are closed to brotherhood. We, for our part, are not set in our ideas. We want to learn as well as to teach. There are things I wrote of spiritualism 20 years ago which, in the light of wider experience, I would not write today, and to cite these as evidence against me is to deny the possibility of human progress. I was trained in a rigid tradition, and it has taken many years to win to a position where I could stand on my own feet, beholden to none, and with none in a position to call me to account under the oath of the mysteries for my actions. That is now my happy position, and I offer and ask for the pooling of knowledge by all who have anything to pool. Only thus can knowledge advance, and there is no religion higher than the truth. Loyalty to truth ranks higher than loyalty to personalities. I am no believer in the right to give oneself a dispensation to break a solemn oath, but I am also no believer in the right to enforce that oath in a spirit of exclusiveness and pride of possession. The occult fraternities may be proud of their long descent and gorgeous rites, but true wisdom is humble, and compassionate to human needs, and if in our secret archives we have, as I know we have no type to guard it as our secret heritage, but should make it available for all who need it. January 1943 The Germans finally surrender to Soviet forces in Stalingrad. Adolf Hitler orders the total mobilization of the German people. Authorities can now order men and women to undertake any task necessary for the defense of the Reich. Arthurian symbolism was prominent in the early letters, and in letter 87, with its associated meditation on the waking of Arthur, Dion Fortune had drawn attention to its importance in the protection and vitality of the group soul of the nation. This line of work was later followed up by another brilliant medium and psychic within the Society of the Inner Light, Margaret Lumley Brown. Some of the early inner plane communication on the subject, as received by Dion Fortune, is to be found in the fourth and fifth monthly letters. Monthly letter number 4, for January 1943 and number 5, for February 1943. Teaching concerning Arthurian legends. Received through the mediumship of Dion Fortune. I. There is a matter that has been dominating your minds. Whatever is dominating the minds of those who come makes a stepping off place. Thus if you want consecutive teaching you should fill your minds with the previous communications. However, there is no waste of time in considering the bearing of scholarship upon the study of the mysteries in general and, in particular, the Arthurian legends of which the Grail forms a part. The same type of story can be traced through many a mythology and scholars collate them, tracing the common factors in widely diversified schools and traditions. This is valuable because knowledge is never entirely without value. First, there is the question of collating legends with one another and with other traditions. Take the Grail or the Wounded King. There are many versions of the Wounded King within the Arthurian tradition and many versions of the Grail story spread through other traditions. There are certain factors in the human mind which are common to all men, and when expressed in symbolism, will be expressed in related symbolism. There are others which have been developed within a specific school of doctrine. The Grail story concerns the common needs of all mankind. The healing of the Wounded King by a specific method concerns a particular school of doctrine. The one is a primary, the other a secondary legend. In dealing with the mythology of the mysteries, the scholarship required should afford a background that covers the whole range of cognate thought so that you can judge of a given story whether it is a primary legend with its roots in the deepest instinctual level of human need, the level from which dreams arise, or whether it is the creation of the conscious mind to point to moral. There should be a scholarship adequate to the understanding of the sources of these two types of material. To understand a primary legend, you need knowledge of the human mind at its primitive level, both in the present and in the past. Knowledge of its primary level in the present is to be sought in analytical psychology. Knowledge of its primitive level in the past is to be sought, first, in the records of primitive mankind in ancient days, and secondly in the customs and beliefs of peoples who retain their primitive level of culture. The sources of secondary legends are literary, to be sought in the superficial meaning of primary legends interpreted in the light of contemporary influences, religious and cultural. So, therefore, in studying a given story, scholarship is needed to determine the date of its first appearance. Does it go back to the archaic forms of the traditions and the earliest records of them? Does it first appear in a primitive form, expressed in terms of primitive thought, and are there analogous stories in other traditions? Or does it appear only at a later date in a sophisticated form, and is it peculiar to the Arthurian tradition? This will enable you to determine and distinguish what is fundamental and valid, the work of true seers, from what is superficial and misleading, the work of the moralizing theologian or literary fancy. I want to correct one point: the earlier form is the work of many minds, the racial mind, not the seership may shine through a purely literary work. Now let us trace the matter historically. The earliest form of all legends is in the work of the storyteller to the tribe gathered around the campfire. It is childish imagining concerning the nature of things. In the next stage, the minds of the priestly caste work over the primitive stories. At a later stage, a new concept of religion may arise and push aside the primitive. Or conquest by invaders may bring a new race and air culture into influence, and the old culture will be forgotten except by the story tellers among the submerged people. So the primitive tradition returns into the custody of the bards again. Then the new culture may grow a feet, and it may be sought to re-illumine the altar fires from the primitive sources. So men who constitute themselves the new priesthood of the new age may seek for inspiration in the bardic tradition once more. So you see the alternating generations of bard and priest. It follows from this that accurate scholarship in the historical sense cannot exist in such matters, and the true scholarship is psychological, which shall enable you to separate the primitive, which is valuable, from the literary and moralistic, which is valueless and misleading. The basic sources of the Arthurian and Grail stories are pre-Christian, bardic, to be sought in the primitive Celtic religion. The literary and moralistic influences which worked over there, primitive story, are to be sought in medieval religious thought and the troubadour viewpoint. Medieval religious thought confuses the issue by obliterating the traces of the primitive impulses and viewpoint of mankind and moralizing the subject matter. But the troubadours have the same viewpoint as the bards, for they developed their culture in the land where the influences of the old gods lived on, the southern part of France, home of the Albigenses. The Albigenses owed much to the same source. A great mystery cult centered around Montana Sega, the background of the Truvia, the secret cult of Queen Venus, and without understanding that, you will not understand the Arthurian romantic tales. The Arthurian tradition falls into two divisions, the Round Table stories and the Grail stories, but they are woven together by later analysts by the concept of the quest. The knightly quests, which concern adventures with elemental forces, are elaborated into the spiritual quest of the Grail, and the Grail is restored to its place in the custody of women. The Round Table formula concerns elemental forces, and the Grail formula concerns spiritual forces, and these form the lesser and the greater mysteries of the Arthurian tradition. Look for the basic roots of the tradition in druidical influences. Seek its finest flower in mystical Christianity. And remember that in the background is the secret cult of Queen Venus. So you have those three factors: the druidical, the witch, cult, and Christian mysticism. The druidical is a nature, cult, sun, worship, the northern cult, the worship of Queen Venus. The Mediterranean or southern cult derives its inspiration from the remains of the Roman culture, which derived from Greek sources primarily, with secondary tributaries from Mithraic and Persian sources. And the Greek tradition owed a very great deal to the Egyptian, and the Egyptian, in a later and debased form, influenced Roman thought. Those are your factors in the Arthurian tradition, and scholarship is needed to determine the varying degrees of their influence in any given form of legend. The early forms are naturally the most valuable because they are nearest to druidical influences. But the Truvia forms are also valuable because the Truviers were initiates of the cult of Queen Venus, and as such they understood the bardic viewpoint. The Truviers and the Troubadours represented the esoteric and exoteric aspects of that brief flowering of Mediterranean culture that was stamped out in the Albigensian persecution. You will need to be on your guard in dealing with legends which are given specifically Christian form of the Roman communion as distinguished from the mystical Christian form of the Celtic tradition, and you can tell these apart quite readily. Where the exponent of the Christian viewpoint as a priest, a monk or a nun, you are dealing with the Roman influence. Where the exponent is a hermit or anchorite, you are dealing with the primitive Celtic influence. Those are the lines that scholarship should pursue in relation to the Arthurian myth. It refers to the history of the early ages. The Roman civilization was a conquering, military civilization. The Greek was a civilization of the mind and its influence was intellectual. The Greek culture, which is the basis of European culture, derived from several sources. It was first influenced by its own archaic tradition that lingered on in the islands and highlands of Greece when the cities became sophisticated. But this primitive religion, like all primitive religions, was a fertility cult of crops, herds and human beings. Then came the development of the state religion of the Olympian deities, and the old gods were forgotten. A later age outgrew the state religion, and turned to Egypt and Persia for the inspiration of their mysteries. Persia derived her mysteries from India and Chaldea. Egypt derived from Atlantis, and the influence of Egypt reached even to India. So may we trace the root source of all to Atlantis via Egypt and the Far and Near East, and also to those sacred islands in the North Sea and the North, western coasts of Europe where Atlantean influence penetrated. The druidical mysteries derive direct from Atlantis as do the Egyptian, and the Greek mystery cults drew their inspiration from Egypt and Persia, the priestly influence, and used the ancient material of the traditions lingering in the folk tales of the highlands and islands of Greece as their symbolic texture, the bardic influence. Rome drew her civilization originally from Greek influences, and when she became sophisticated, drew on the mystery cults of Greece, Persia and Egypt. And these cults, as well as the state religion, traveled with the legions, and wherever Roman troops settled down in occupation, mystery schools were established. The Roman policy was to assimilate the barbarian, and leading men of the local tribes were encouraged to send their sons to Rome to be educated. Very often they were taken as hostages when they were children, and given a Roman education, and then sent back to their tribes to rule under the tutelage of Rome. So Roman civilization became naturalized in the conquered provinces. The mystery cults, being derived from primitive sources, presented no difficulties to the people of the conquered provinces, who had been nurtured in a similar tradition, and they were readily identified by them as their familiar deities. So the mystery cults took hold and flourished. And when the Roman legions were rolled back by the barbarian hordes, the mystery cults lived on, having struck root in the soil. These persisted as a pagan, or as later termed a witch, cult tradition that still persists in the folk lore of remote parts where the civilizing influences of the centers of culture have not penetrated. It was on these sources that the Truviers drew. Now the Truviers and the Troubadours and the Cathartics and the Albigenses all developed their thought and systems under an impulse of intellectual activity which defied Catholicism and Christianity and formed part of the great heretical movements that were stamped out by persecution. And the Truviers, who represented the pagan mysticism of that movement, developed a cult of mystery schools based on the ancient traditions of the old mysteries brought to that land by the Roman legions, who derived them from the Greek and Egyptian mysteries. This bardic tradition of the Truvaiyas recognizing cognate material in the druidical tradition of the Arthurian stories, made use of them in the same way as the Egyptian, initiated Greek mysteries drew on the primitive Greek nature, cult for the myths which gave the formulae of the Eleusinian mysteries. The druidical form of the Arthurian tradition profoundly influenced the Celtic Christianity that developed in these islands. So we may say then, that the true Arthurian tradition is to be sought in the druidical, the Celtic Christian, and the Truvia sources, which know nothing of priesthood or monasteries or nunneries, but are familiar with hermits and holy pilgrims. The hermit, the pilgrim, the magician and the fairy woman, these characterize the true tradition, and the priest, monastic organization and the witch characterize the sophisticated medieval or Renaissance glosses on the primitive tradition, which are to be discarded as misleading. For instance, King Arthur being taken in death by the fairy woman is primitive material and as such psychologically valid, Lancelot and Guinevere repenting them of their sins in their respective religious communities are later glosses, and as such, to be discarded from the mystery tradition. You now see how and where to trace your sources. At the back of the Truvia recension of the Arthurian myth was the Queen Venus cult, which kept secret, and later developed into the witch cult, which contained features not recorded by the historians, and there was a highly developed cult of the women which showed itself clearly in Truvia and Troubadour literature and in the courts of love, but which was discreetly ignored by the worthy Malory. Krishan used Truvia material and had more insight. Ashtoreth was the forerunner of Queen Venus and Guinevere was her successor. The records have been deliberately expunged. So we take their bones, in this valley of dead bones, and clothe them with the mysteries, so that bone cleaves to bone and they become alive again. March 1943. In another attempt to assassinate Hitler, a bomb planted by German army officers on a plane carrying Hitler failed to go off. The foundations now start to be laid for the work of the fraternity in the post-war period. A new study course is announced for those who aspire to membership, together with an appeal for financial support to aid the expanding venture. The weekly open meditation group has now ceased, and despite some requests that it be continued in some form, the focus of the group is now moving inward and the future lies with the training of dedicated initiates. Nonetheless, in the sixth monthly letter Dion Fortune takes some pains to spell out the way for any who seek to make their first steps upon the path. The door is not closed even if it is no longer held wide open. Headline, picture text. Monthly letter number 6, for March 1943. Equinox Appeal and the New Study Course. Equinox Appeal. The vernal equinox comes round once more, and we must make our biannual appeal for financial support to those who consider our work sufficient value to be maintained in being through the difficult days of the war, when there is little opportunity for personal participation for most people. Our friends have been more than good in the support they have afforded us, and we hope and believe that this will be continued. As with everyone else, our expenses are rising and our income falling. It is only because of a member who, during the past year having received an unexpected windfall of capital, has most generously passed on the benefit to the fraternity that we have been able to remain solvent, and we cannot expect this to happen a second time. Either we must find ways to increase our income or the falling financial tide will sooner or later leave us stranded. We should welcome suggestions from the friends of the fraternity as well as its members. We should also welcome suggestions for developments in our work. Recently we have had letters from more than one person asking for a renewal of the meditation work by the setting of meditation subjects for the month in the pages of this letter. An effectual meditation group could not be formed in this way. It must have as its nucleus a group of people who sit in circle formation with someone trained in meditation as the leader. We should be glad to know whether there are any among our friends and members who would be prepared to join such a group if it were formed, also what hour and day would be considered most convenient. If the scheme proves feasible, we will arrange for such a group to meet in the library at our headquarters, and for instruction papers to be got out concerning the method to be used by those working at a distance. In spite of wartime conditions, We are steadily adding to the library by the purchase and the gift of books. We have good facilities for exchanging duplicates, or selling advantageously books unsuitable for our shelves, and we hope our friends will give the library their support both as borrowers and donors so that it may be the better equipped for its useful work. So far as we know, there is no other occult library in the country that gets the new books as we do. The new study course, it is not possible for many people to pursue the studies and submit to the discipline of the training that leads to initiation, yet nevertheless much useful work could be done by sincerely dedicated persons, and esoteric schools like industry, must be prepared to organize the energies of part-time workers. We have therefore devised an initial training course that shall enable people to co-operate with the mystery tradition without the necessity of actually taking initiation. Those who desire to do so can, of course, go on to further training, but there is a wide field of useful work that can be done in the outer court by those who are sincere in their desire to serve, provided they can grasp the main ideas and are prepared to go to work systematically. The mystery tradition has often been likened to an iceberg, of which but a small proportion is above the surface and the great mass out of sight. But a small part of an esoteric order exists on the physical plane. All the greater and more important aspects are on the inner planes. The mundane aspect of an order is practically nothing but a training school wherein mind training is done, a mind training designed to serve spiritual ends, for schools of the right-hand path are most careful that their training shall never be used for ends of personal power and aggrandizement. Those who are fully trained learn to use the channel of communication with the inner planes both for the receiving of teaching and instruction and the bringing through of that concentrated form of spiritual force that enables the service of God and man to be performed with power. It is obvious that such work can only be entrusted to carefully chosen and trained persons. But we found in the days when we threw open our doors during the siege of London that the tensions of war had brought spiritual growth to the nation en masse, and that a very great many people were ready and able to co-operate in the work of the mystery tradition. In order to do this, they have, first and foremost, to get into touch with the tradition on the inner planes, so that they become, in the language of the mysteries, on their contacts, without which no work can be done. Getting into touch with the mysteries depends on two things: knowing where to look, and the right approach. Knowing where to look depends on right information. The right approach depends on the right kind of character, and this is a character that has a selfless desire to serve and a willingness to observe discipline. The desire to serve by itself is not enough. The road to hell is proverbially paved with good intentions, because work in connection with an esoteric order involves cooperation with others, both on the physical plane and on the inner planes, and unless people are prepared to observe some sort of simple rule, such cooperation is impossible. The aim of the organization of an order or fraternity is to render cooperation possible between the physical plane and the inner planes. The spiritualist movement demonstrates the possibility of communication, but it is the mystery tradition that practices cooperation. Granted the right kind of character, it is only necessary to indicate where to look in order that the search may be rewarded, for those who approach in the right spirit carry the key in their hands. The place in which to look for the mystery tradition is on the inner planes. We turn inward, into the silence, to make our contacts, not to any spot on the physical earth. The contact with the masters on the inner planes is made by thinking about them. The pictorial imagination is one of the principal instruments used in esoteric work, and by careful training and constant practice it is brought to a very fine edge. In consequence, it is possible to build up very clear-cut and detailed mental images. These images are, in reality, astral thought forms, and they are the channels through which the invisible forces work. In order to enable the imagination to get to function, it has to be provided with material, just as a novelist who wanted to write an historical novel would study the period in which he proposed to lay his scene until he could picture it in all its detail of dress, architecture and customs. Most of the students who enrolled in our study courses in the past already knew a good deal about esoteric science when they came to us. We have always been teachers of teachers, training in the high ranges of knowledge people who were already experienced in occult studies. Consequently, there was in our study courses little that the beginner could make a start upon. We had no propaganda. Students who came to us had to pick up our trail on the inner planes, consequently they had to have at least some natural aptitude and a certain amount of knowledge before they made contact. In fact, we found that, almost without exception, they had been initiates of the tradition in past lives, and we come to look upon this as a sine qua non of initiation into our fraternity.